Hello, I'm Mark Silverman. This is number 0337, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0337. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet Mike Wolf, who is a rather hirsute guy who has turned his back hair into a canvas with a calendar called Calendair. How did this all get started?
I was actually the best man in a wedding in 2007. We were going to Hawaii, so I went over to a buddy's house and I had him shave around a tank top. So I went to Waikiki Beach and threw off my shirt and I had a hair tank top and everybody was laughing and we had a good time with it. So then my birthday is actually July 4th. And in 2008, I said, hey, we're going camping this weekend. I need an American flag in my back. He came over on the 2nd, shaved me in the American flag, and then we went camping that weekend and it was a huge hit. And that just kind of flowed from there.
Ron Irwin is the author of Mass Murders in America.
You got to think about the psychology of anybody, whatever their motivations might be, that would allow them, because you and I would not do this, but it would allow somebody to calmly walk into a place of business like San Bernardino or around their own neighborhood and just shoot people, kill them without any feeling, without any emotion.
Florence Ann Romano is the Windy City Nanny. She's written a book called Nanny and Me. Many nannies have been depicted in the movies. Who's her favorite?
Mrs. Doubtfire. I think that really blends together so many of the realistic themes that you see in families today. Now, maybe not realistic as your ex-husband dressing up as now your new nanny, but the themes that they really explore in that movie really are things you find in families today. The mother, she's really looking for someone that is an extension of her, an extension of her values and her parenting, and that's why she falls in love with Mrs. Doubtfire so much, because she's exactly the type of person that she wants caring for her children.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0337 was Mark Silverman. He's the strategy director at Critical Mass, which is based in Chicago. And Mark used to be one of the producers of my old radio show back in the day. Way, way back in the day. Way, way, way back in the day. Thank you very much, Mark, for doing the guest slate on this program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, I actually enjoy the occasional snowstorm. I like it when fresh snow blankets the entire city. Plus, I find that besides Christmas, it's one of the only times of the year when people seem to be nice to each other and neighbors help out. Except perhaps in New Jersey, or at least in Newark. As you may know, they just recently went through a snowstorm where they had 2 feet of snow dumped on them. Now, according to Newark police, a 38-year-old victim told officers he found a shovel on the ground outside a neighbor's home. As he dug away at the snow, however, he was confronted by a female neighbor who claimed the shovel belonged to her. The man returned the shovel, but while walking back to his home, he was again accosted by the woman and 3 men, one of whom pointed a gun at the victim's head. At the woman's command, the assailant fired a single shot at the victim, striking him in the buttocks. The victim attempted to grab the gun, but was struck in the mouth by a second woman during the ensuing battle. He then fled back to his home while the group of attackers fled in a vehicle. There is no report of what happened to the shovel, by the way. Well, you know, I watched every episode of The Sopranos, and if I remember correctly, they had other uses for shovels than on snow. So maybe this guy just got off lucky. Oh, sure, he was shot in the ass, but, you know. Anyway, moving right along, a 31-year-old Puerto Rican poker player who died recently was treated to his hobby one last time when his body was seated at a card table during his wake. The family of Henry Rosario Martinez, age 31, contacted the Eternal Light Funeral Home in Barceloneta after his death and asked that the man's remains be embalmed, dressed, and seated at a poker table during his wake. Martinez's wake included poker games with the corpse seated at the table and friends and family posing for pictures with the deceased. Nothing ghoulish about that, huh? I wanted him to be remembered as a happy person because he was always like that, his mother, Sonia Martinez, said. Wakes featuring the remains of deceased arranged in lifelike poses are becoming increasingly common in Puerto Rico, with recent examples including a paramedic posed in the back of an ambulance and a man posed at a table playing dominoes. Okay, so let me see if I got this straight. He basically was sitting there, motionless, at the table, embalmed. Talk about your ultimate poker face, huh? Yeah. Police in Michigan were called to a single vehicle accident and found the driver without pants. Police said that the 58-year-old man died after his car crashed and rolled over on the ramp from the lodge to I-75. Police discovered that the driver was watching adult videos while driving his car. The preliminary investigation revealed that the driver of the car was not wearing his seatbelt or his pants when he lost control of the car. He was partially ejected through the sunroof and died at the scene. You know, there is a time and a place for porn, so I hear. But behind the wheel, hurtling at about 60 miles an hour, definitely is not it. Anyway, a police officer in Niceville, Florida, saw a truck driving erratically and pulled the vehicle over. Now, according to the officer, he asked the driver where he was coming from, and the driver said he was going that way. When asked for clarification, the driver said Bluewater Bay. The officer explained to the man that he was coming from a different direction than Bluewater Bay, but the driver insisted he was coming from Bluewater Bay. The officer then asked him where the man was going, and he replied, you guessed it, Bluewater Bay. When the officer pointed out that the man had made a right turn from the left turn lane, running over the median in the process, the man replied, I was just trying to get home. The officer then asked the man for his driver's license, registration, and proof of insurance, and the driver handed him a Ruby Tuesday's restaurant coupon. When the officer pointed out it wasn't his driver's license, the man handed him another Ruby Tuesday's coupon and asked, is this my driver's license here, right? According to the arrest report, this sort of conversation continued for several minutes. A breathalyzer showed the driver's blood alcohol content at approximately 0.2%. You know, something tells me he won't be available to go to Ruby Tuesdays for a while. Meanwhile, still with driving and still with Florida, when three cars sped through the bus driveway at Delray Beach High School, allegedly narrowly missing several students in the area after school, officers from the Palm Beach County School District Police, driving a golf cart, blocked the drive to force them to stop. Officers asked the drivers for their license. One of the drivers, Volvic Louis Jean Jr., who was 18 years old, who the officers, by the way, recognize as a former student, handed over a copy of his homemade rap CD. All three drivers, police say, then peeled out and fled, again narrowly missing several students. Jean was arrested on charges of reckless driving, driving with a suspended license, trespassing on school ground, and fleeing and eluding police. It is unclear whether the other two drivers were identified or charged. Then again, how can we tell who the other drivers were? They didn't have rap CDs to hand out. I'm guessing this is not going to be the kind of rap that Jean will be able to beat, or put a beat to, for that matter. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a woman showed up at a Padua, Italy firehouse seeking help. I lost the keys to a lock and I can no longer open it. Naturally, the firefighters asked where she lived. But when she got her clothing out of the way, they saw what her problem really was. She'd locked herself in a chastity belt and couldn't get it off. I'll leave that line alone. The firefighters broke the lock. The unnamed woman said she had put the iron device on voluntarily to keep herself from getting into a sexual relationship. But of course, to have it removed, she had to go and visit what's considered worldwide the universal location for hot guys. A fire station. Yeah. She wouldn't discover any sexual urges there. No. Not gonna happen. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? Mike Wolf from Idaho has an extremely hairy back, but he's not hiding it. Thanks to his friend Tyler Harding, he's turned it into art, which you can display year-round on Calendar. And in case you haven't figured that out, that is a calendar featuring back hair art. Mike joins us on the line right now from Idaho. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So I saw the story online, including on the website, the pictures of you. Tell us how this all started. Because, you know, most guys don't share their back hair with people.
Hardly anybody does, man.
So how did this start?
Well, what happened was, I was actually the best man in a wedding in 2007, and we were going to Hawaii, so I went over to a buddy's house, and I had him shave around a tank top, and so I went to Waikiki Beach and threw off my shirt, and I had a hair tank top, and everybody was laughing, and we had a good time with it. So then my birthday is actually July 4th, and in 2008, I called up my same friend that would shave, you know, shave that tank top, and I said, hey, we're going camping this weekend. I need an American flag in my back. He just started laughing. As you can imagine, he's like, well, I think I could do something like that. And so he came over on the 2nd, shaved me in the American flag, and then we went camping that weekend, and it was a huge hit. And I just kind of flowed from there.
Okay. I'm looking at the pictures, some of the pictures that are on your website, and I see the American flag one. First of all, how long does it take your friend Tyler to do the artwork on your back?
It takes about an hour to draw it because we want to make it right. So we'll draw it in, we'll go and sketch it in, and then it only takes about an hour or more to shave it. Okay. Depending on the one for December, which is my favorite one, which is away in a main chair, right?
Right.
And so it's the nativity scene, and that one took about 2.5 hours because there's a lot of intricate detail.
Now, I've seen the video where he's doing the artwork on your back, and I'm assuming that you're not at all ticklish.
I actually am, but I'll tell you what, a guy with that kind of back hair, your back itches 24/7, so it feels good, actually, to have it itched a little bit for about an hour and a half.
And once the artwork is done, now you've got this calendar, 2016, which shows 12 different shots. So I got to ask, how long does it take after the artwork is done for the hair to grow back?
You know, it takes 4 months to get a good canvas. 4 months, and if you really want to, dent, you got to go 5 months. So really, you can only do 2 or 3 of them a year. So that's why it's taken us since 2010, and really we had 2 done before that to get a full calendar. So you can't produce one of these every year.
Now, do you, when you take the pictures which have become part of the calendar, do you then shave your entire back and let it all grow out evenly, or do you just let it grow?
No, usually I just let it go, and once it grows back, and because it's not going to just keep on, right? I mean, you're not going to be able to play Tarzan from it if I let it go for a year, but once it grows out to a certain length, it usually stops. And so it gets to be an even canvas after about 4 months.
Now, you're also using some of the proceeds for this calendar to a good cause, are you not?
Absolutely, yeah. It's called Gates of Hope. It's an orphanage out of Nairobi, Kenya. And we're supporting kids through education and medical needs.
How did you come about choosing that particular event or that organization for your charity?
Well, a buddy of mine from college, his name is Mike Hammer, he went over there for his internship and just fell in love with the kids, you know, and his heart went out to the kids, so he came back and was passionate about it. So we started supporting that orphanage in 2002, you know, very, very lightly, because, I mean, we're all either still in college or just graduated college, so there's not a lot of means that we had. And so we're trying to support them with whatever we could. And over the years, as we're all, you know, growing in the workforce, it's just become more and more. And then this idea came about, and I said, hey, let's do the proceeds to get these kids educated. And everybody loved it. So that's how it came about.
Now that the word is out there and you have this calendar, or calendar, I should say, what's the reaction like? I mean, here you are talking to somebody in Canada, but you've received a lot of media attention. What's that been like for you?
A lot different than I expected. I thought this would be a good thing for, you know, friends and family and some people. You know, you put it on Facebook and maybe some people would take it. But then once Channel 7 did their piece here in Boise and they put it on the Associated Press, it's gone crazy. So we just were on the Steve Harvey Show last week. We taped a taping of the Steve Harvey Show last week, and then we've done live TV from Australia, and we've been having a lot of fun with it. Let me just put it that way. We've been having a lot of fun with it. It is a little bit hectic because we have our day jobs, but it's been a lot of fun.
And your day job is?
I'm a medical device distributor, so I go in on surgeries for surgical implants.
Okay. Now, again, besides the media that you've already referred to, one of the back art depictions that you've had involved Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show, correct?
Hey, if everybody can help me on your show, get on there. I would love it. That would be a lot of fun.
Well, that's what I was about to ask.
We did that because NBC, Channel 7 is an NBC affiliate here, and they wanted us to do something fun for their affiliate. And so I said, well, why don't we do Jimmy Fallon's logo? And they said, yeah, it's a great idea. So we decided to put that on there.
So have you heard at all from the Tonight Show people?
No, we haven't. We've submitted it just about every way we know how. So if anybody else knows how, let's get some help. I appreciate it.
Well, it's one of the things. I also saw a video. I think it might have been the Channel 7 video where you got the blessing, I guess, of your wife to go along with this. She's a very understanding woman.
Funny because back when when we first started dating, I was, I think, a freshman in college. I was nervous, and so I was narrowing my back all the time. Right? Yeah, I was a little self conscious about it. I'm not going to lie. And finally, I just got sick and tired of doing that, and so I took her out on a date one time, and I just said, hey, listen, I got something to tell you. And she goes, oh, yeah, what's that? She had no clue what to think. And I was like, you know, I have back hair. And she started laughing. She goes, no, you don't. I said, no, exactly, I don't, because I near it. But if I didn't near it, it'd just be a freaking veritable forest out there. And she just started laughing. She was like, I don't care. Just do what you want to do. So from that point on, I started growing it out and doing stupid stuff with it.
Hmm. Well, how old were you, by the way, when you first started shaving?
First shaving, I guess, would have been by shaving my face or my back.
Just everything, because I'm assuming that you are just overall a very hairy guy.
I was in eighth grade when I was shaving my face. Eighth grade, shaving my face, and then we did our first back shaving. Like I said, I think it was in 07. So I was born in the 80s, so I would have been 27.
Okay. Okay, so now that are you coming up with new ideas, or in addition with Tyler?
Oh, absolutely.
What kinds of things do you want to add to the back hair art?
Well, since you can't do a calendar every year, I want to get into what I like to call hair mark cards, which are kind of like Hallmark cards with their hair. And so you get into the greeting cards, the different month birthday cards, the gag gift cards, all that type of stuff. That'd be a lot of fun. And so we're working on that right now.
Have you been hearing from other people who are like yourself, rather hirsute?
Yeah. We've gotten a few emails saying this is great. Thanks. You know, it's helped me out a little bit, and I'm not as ashamed.
I could see a bunch of you guys getting together and having a collection put together. Maybe that's the next step. Yep. You know, instead of your back, how about having 12 guys all together on display?
My buddy who does the shaving. He's like, you know what? The next idea, panoramic. And so once he said panoramic, of course I had to say panoramic, because it's going to be a panoramic shaving.
How can people get their hands on the calendar 2016 calendar? I mean, we're already to the end of January, but there's still 11 months to go.
It's still a great gag gift. It's still a great gag. Yeah, guys, go on to www.calendhair. So just CalendHair, calendhair.com. And you can buy it through a PayPal account there. And again, we appreciate it, of course, but you know, proceeds are going to help the kids out in Nairobi, Kenya, with through Gates of Hope. There's a link on that website to Gates of Hope's website, too, so you can see what's going on.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like you're having a lot of fun with this, Mike. Thanks very much. And you know, I guess people have already made the connection. It's not surprising that your last name is Wolf, right?
No. People have definitely made the connection. You know, the funny thing is I'm the only person in my family with anybody there.
Wow. Anyway, Mike, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
Mike Wolf, the hirsute model from Calendhair. Again, you can check out his website at calendhair.com. I urge you to go and check it out and buy a calendar, by the way. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0337, and you'll find links to their site.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about mass murderers and nannies. And trust me, we won't be discussing both of those things at the same time. Two separate topics, two separate guests, I assure you. We also have more Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day coming your way. All here on a program heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get back to the news, shall we? Police officers were surprised when they kicked in the door of an Amsterdam man they thought was in trouble and shouting, only to discover he was actually trying to sing along with an opera recording. The man was enjoying his music, wearing headphones, and did not notice the police at his door. The police were responding to an emergency call placed by a neighbor who suspected the man was a victim of a violent domestic crime. The tipster told the dispatcher he, quote, heard a terrifying scream from the house, police said. When police arrived on the scene, they also heard screams from inside the house. The resident did not come to the door until after officers kicked it in. He was alone inside at the time. So, I guess we can make the assumption that he was a bad opera singer. Because if your opera singing sounds like there's domestic violence going on, perhaps you should stop. 24-year-old Timothy Ortiz was fired from his job at a Palencia, Florida Burger King. According to witnesses, Ortiz walked out of the restaurant, set his uniform hat and shirt on fire, left them on the ground, and walked away. Witnesses saw what Ortiz had done and called police, but he was gone by the time they arrived. When police arrived at his home, the police report says he was yelling and cursing at a deputy, grew more aggressive, and refused to be handcuffed. So the deputy fired his stun gun at Ortiz as he allegedly started running away, but the probes did not stick. When the deputy reloaded his stun gun, Ortiz decided to return and submit to arrest. The one smart thing he did all day. You see, at Burger King, when they say, have it your way, they're talking about the customers, not the staff. Okay? On Martin Luther King Day, a Logan Farms Honey Glazed Hams restaurant in Houston, Texas, noted a promotion on their sign out front. Brown and gay employees get half-price plate lunch this week only. A local TV station reports they received angry calls and emails regarding the special treatment that the restaurant was giving brown and gay people. A reporter contacted the restaurant to see what was going on. The owners were pretty confused, the reporter said. No one had complained to them. Then co-owner James Logan realized what was up and said the controversy was hilarious. The sign had nothing to do with MLK Day, but rather offers a discount to the employees of Brown and Gay Engineering, who often walk across the street for lunch. The company's principals are Pat Brown and Richard Gay. Logan Farms changed their sign to reference BGE employees to clarify things, and Logan says because the firm prefers to go by its initials anyway. Because in Texas, openly being brown and gay is enough to trigger a lynching in some parts, as you may know. Okay, we have a couple of stories here now that highlight how the state of New Jersey might be sending awkward signals or are a bit unclear on the concept. Story number one. The government watchdog Muckrock requested records on the cause of death of a dolphin in New Jersey's South River last year to investigate larger dangers to the animal. But in January, the state's Department of Agriculture initially declined to release them, citing medical privacy, usually requested for autopsies by the deceased's family. Medical privacy for a dolphin? Really? Wow. And story number two in this little section on New Jersey, not really being clear on the concept. At that same time, Maria Vaccarella is facing a $1,000 fine and possibly up to 6 months in jail in Howell, New Jersey, for violating a state law because she illegally rendered care to two apparently orphaned baby squirrels, which Maria named George and Lola, when their mother abandoned them. It was always the plan for Maria and her family to get these animals back into the wild where they belong. But Maria said before they could do that, two officers were at her front door. Fish and Wildlife, they said, we saw a picture on Facebook and asked, do you have squirrels? And she said, yes, I do have squirrels. Would you like to come in and see them? All they said is, I cannot keep the squirrels. Fine by me, I said. George and Lola will now be rehabilitated by professionals. And Maria thought that was the end of it, but she was wrong. A summons later came in the mail saying that she had broken the law and needed to come to court. Wow. Could you imagine potentially spending 6 months in jail for harboring baby squirrels? Gee, that would make you the tough queen bee of cell block D, wouldn't it? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in December, a judge in Hamburg, New York, dismissed a DUI charge against a motorist who had registered a 0.33 blood alcohol reading because her lawyer had convinced the court that she suffered from gut fermentation syndrome, that her digestive system makes so much yeast from ordinary food and beverages that it functions like a brewery. Okay. So if this gut fermentation syndrome is indeed true, isn't that an even better reason why a person shouldn't drink? I mean, the woman in question didn't drink enough to be legally drunk, but she did drink. If she literally has an internal brewery going on there, she really shouldn't be adding to it. That's like a diabetic eating an entire box of sugar cubes. I'm just saying. Anyway. Let's get to our next guest, shall we? Former criminal defense attorney and author Ron Irwin has released his latest book entitled Mass Murders in America. It presents a detailed rendition of 30 of the deadliest mass murders in American history, from the Walk the Death in Camden, New Jersey in 1949, to the still simmering carnage at the Inland Regional Center in San Bernardino, California just last year. Ron joins us on the line via Skype right now from Burbank, California. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Peter. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Again, you have this book with 30 of the deadliest mass murders. And I would, in just the two that I mentioned, there's a different kind of situation involved here. I mentioned the Walk of Death in 1949. 13 people, including three children, were killed by a guy who lived in their community and only died in prison, in 2009, at the age of 88. Whereas when you mention something like San Bernardino, that's a terrorism attack, a totally different mindset. Has mass murderers over the years changed?
You know, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure to what extent. Yeah, absolutely. The attacks in San Bernardino were linked to terror, but you got to think about the psychology of anybody, whatever their motivations might be, that would allow them, because you and I would not do this, but it would allow somebody to calmly walk into a place of business like San Bernardino or around their own neighborhood and just shoot people, kill them, without any feeling, without any emotion that's ascertainable. But yeah, it's different. You know, the interesting thing about the guy in Camden who started it all, at least for my book, I'm sure he wasn't the first man, but he was a war hero from World War II. And if he had been a recent veteran of a conflict, be it, you know, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, any of those, he would be called suffering from PTSD, I think.
Right.
Whereas I don't know what the people in San Bernardino were suffering from, except a very distorted view of their religion, interestingly enough. One of the motivating factors to get me to write this book was to look at the religious element in any of these, and there's not much. The people in San Bernardino, yeah, and then, of course, the guy that ran around Fort Hood in Texas.
Hmm. Now
that's 3 out of 30.
Right. Now, even though the two that we mentioned, 1949 and just last year, are very different, now that I think about it, there is one thing both seem to have in common. If I'm not mistaken, the first guy ran through his own neighborhood. The second guy went to a place where he worked and there was a party.
Exactly.
These are mass murderers of people that they knew in some respect.
Very often. I mean, you take one of the most hideous ones, Adam Lanza, Sandy Hook. You know, his first victim that day was his mother.
Right.
And in many of these stories, the first victims, or sometimes the entire total list of victims, are family. It's like, okay, you got to watch out for the crazy brother over there or whatever, because Adam Lanza, he was diagnosed psychotic at age 6, I believe, and he was being treated and given medications. The mother fought it every inch of the way. And actually thought it would be a great idea to take him out and teach him how to use a firearm effectively. Well, I guess he learned.
Yeah. Now,
then he used the first one he used offensively was on her.
In writing this book, and in doing the research, what is it that what's the biggest thing that you learned in doing the research for this book, Mass Murders, America?
Well,
America.
Three things. First of all, it's psychopathy, always a sociopathy, possibly, always is present. There's mental illness always present. Well over 80% had been diagnosed in some manner, shape, or form. Many of them had put on medications. In some cases, the medications may have actually aggravated the situation. That's something you also have to be careful of. And people, given a population of the world today, which is, 7 billion, the U.S. a little over 300 million, there's always going to be some people out there that have the ability and the means and the desire to commit mass carnage for whatever reason or lack of reason, to drive in to example, a restaurant in Killeen, Texas. I mean, literally drive through the window and then start shooting. That takes a psychopathy. Most people wouldn't even consider that. So that's always present. The other interesting fact that I found was the majority of these people came from broken families and many times from abusive families. So there's a certain commonality in that.
It seems of late that mass murderers that we look at in the most recent situations are people who, in the course of their crime, either are planning to or certainly want to die. Is that always the case, or was that always the case?
It's very heavily the case. It's not universal, but the vast majority of them either die from self-inflicted or suicide by cop. Hmm.
Yet, when I mentioned the first one, The Walk of Death, 1949, as I mentioned, he lived till 88, mind you, in an asylum, but he
yes.
lived to be 88.
Yeah, he did, and interesting, you know, another way, talk about an interesting one and didn't quite live that long, but lived in jail for a while, was Richard Speck, and Richard Speck actually released a video to a news guy I used to know back in Chicago, Bill Curtis. And in that video, one of the comments he made, he at the time had taken some hormone shots and had female-type breasts. His comment was, if they only knew how much fun I was having here in prison, they would release me.
Wow.
So I'm thinking we're not talking about a mentally healthy person.
Now, I would assume also in most cases, the San Bernardino shooting aside, because that was a couple, that in most cases, they're all men we're talking about.
Only one woman. Only one female, yeah, and that would have been San Bernardino. I think women are more prone to drive people to commit. No, it's that was a terrible joke. But yeah, only one woman, and of course, that relationship is still being very heavily examined by everybody at every level, because, you know, people at the government level and the law enforcement level and the intelligence level want to be able to find these people before they launch an attack, which I think is a really good mission.
When you started on this journey writing this book, Mass Murders in America, who were you looking at as your potential audience for the book?
You know, that's, again, you're spot on some great questions. I think anybody that has an interest in some of the dangers that surround all of us, and to try to get a sense of how these situations arise. And by the way, there are certain circumstances too, there have been several actually, where a lot of this could have been stopped, but wasn't.
How
where,
so?
Where people have, where one guy, the guy that did the McDonald's shootings, for example, down near San Diego, and he tells his wife, I just want to give you a kiss, honey. I'm going to go out to kill people. I mean, he tells her this. Did she call the police? No.
Is it not
and
possible,
if
though,
if
that
she had called the police, would they have listened to her? Probably not.
But I was just about to say, isn't it a case that if someone were to just casually say that to you, first of all, you'd either think they were joking or you just wouldn't believe them or you'd be in denial?
I know. Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
You're exactly right, and that's part of the problem, which also gets down to the grand summation of the whole thing, which is really, at the end of the day, there's no prevention that's 100% effective, number one. But the good news, and it's really good news, statistically, the odds of being caught up in this, while it could be random, it could be anybody, but the odds are like getting hit by lightning twice in a day.
Right. Now, I bring up the idea of who your audience was for this book. On the other side of that coin, do you worry when you write a book like this? Because, you know, one of the things people always talk about, especially with news coverage, they always say, let's talk more about the victims and let's not talk about the murderer himself because we don't want to give him notoriety or encourage the next one. Did that thought ever cross your mind when writing this book that even though you don't intend to, it might somehow glorify the people that you are actually writing about?
I think if you were to read the book in thorough, there is no glorification that I give to any of these people. They are all cold-blooded killers, and they are identified as such.
But we're also talking about people who have a mental problem in some cases. And when I say glorify, I'm talking about in the mind of someone else who might look at your book and say, I could be in the next book. That kind of thing.
Well,
that's what I mean.
You know, I suppose that possibility exists, but you know, it's hard. There's not a single word you could say that couldn't be twisted, right?
Right.
And yeah, a lot of these guys, like again, there's a couple of them that look back at and worshipped Columbine.
Yeah,
because of all the news media, which, by the way, it was the over-the-top news coverage of San Bernardino, too, that partially motivated me. I wanted to see what the reality was, because what you see on television news is a tiny, tiny fraction of the reality. And it was so prevalent here in Southern California, particularly, I was driven to find out a greater in-depth look. That's part of what the book was about.
Well, it's a fascinating topic. The book is called Mass Murderers in America. Ron, I thank you very, very much for being on the program. The book, I'm sure, is available on Amazon.com, correct?
I believe so. For sure, it's available at BarnesandNoble.com, and it's also at Lulu.com, and it's Mass Murderers in America. And Peter, it's been a joy talking with you.
Ron Irwin, author of Mass Murders in America. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0337, and you'll find links to Ron's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Ask any child what the best part of their school day is, and they'll likely tell you it's recess. That's true whether a child goes to a traditional school or is homeschooled. But now a lawsuit filed against a husband and wife who homeschool their children is taking all the fun out of recess for their kids. Andrew and Kelly Counts began homeschooling their children in Plano, Texas in 2014. With the permission of the city and their neighborhood association, they put a playhouse and swing set in their backyard for the kids to enjoy during study breaks. Unfortunately, they soon found out that their neighbors weren't happy with the sound of kids playing. First, the neighbors began playing vulgar and offensive music when the kids used their playhouse. Then, the neighbors sued them for upsetting what they called their tranquil quality of life. Let's be fair, it sounds like a certain set of neighbors need a lesson in how to settle disputes like adults. If that doesn't work, maybe the judge can give them a timeout. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about nannies. Plus, we do have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. But I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program I also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, under the headline of TMI, in January, the British sex toy company Hot Octopus, trying for a spurt of publicity in New York City, unveiled a reconfigured payphone booth at 5th Avenue and 28th Street in Manhattan that offered a seat, a laptop, a Wi-Fi connection, and a privacy curtain to help people, mostly men, one imagines, relieve stress on both your mind and body. You can pretty much figure that out, can't you? Yeah. A company rep claimed that about 100 men used the booth in its first day, but what the men actually did there is private. Now, what I want to know is, whose job is it to clean up that phone booth? And you know, I guess in today's world, some people have no shame because it's a phone booth. Everyone who walks by will have an idea of basically what it's used for. Do you really want to be seen walking in or out of that booth? Yikes. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Most of us only come in contact with nannies either in the news or in the movies. Another screen nanny is in theaters now with the release of the horror flick The Boy. To talk about that, other cinematic nannies, and the actual job in general, is Florence Ann Romano. She's the author of Nanny and Me, and is also known as the Windy City Nanny. Florence joins us on the line right now from Chicago. Hi, Florence.
Hello, hello. So happy to be here.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, looking over the information and going to your website, which is windycitynanny.com, I realize that, first of all, you've been a nanny from a very early age, and it was before you were an adult. So right off the bat, I have to ask, what's the difference between being a nanny and just simply being a babysitter?
When I started as a mother's helper, really, because I was about 11 years old, and I started shadowing these moms to kind of see really what it was like to start to babysit and take care of children. So when you're at a young age, probably in your teen years, you're going to start as a babysitter, where you're going to be doing that on weekends and getting to know different families. And then as you get older and decide that you really want to make it into more of a profession than just a job, that's when it switches to being a nanny. And every family is going to define their child care differently. Some people will still call you a babysitter, and others will call you their nanny. Nanny was just the term that they used mostly with me. But it generally shifts from a young age to then a more adult age when you start to use the term nanny.
Now, I mentioned there are movies out there. Again, most recently, The Boy. Just in generally in speaking, what do you consider the best depictions of nannies on film?
My favorite nanny film is Mrs. Doubtfire. I think that really blends together so many of the realistic themes that you see in families today. Now, maybe not realistic as someone dressing up as you know, your ex-husband dressing up as now your new nanny. But the themes that they really explore in that movie really are things you find in families today. The mother, she's really looking for someone that is an extension of her, an extension of her values in her parenting, and that's why she falls in love with Mrs. Doubtfire so much, because she's exactly the type of person that she wants caring for her children. And that's my number one rule as a nanny, is find a nanny that is an extension of you as the parent, as the eyes, ears, and heart of the parent.
So I guess that leads to a very rigorous and important interview process in finding the right nanny.
It is super important to remember that interview process is your first glimpse of this person. And why people just have one interview with a nanny or a potential nanny is beyond me, because it really needs to be a tiered process. You need to get to know this person on a true level. So I always suggest a tiered interview process, where you meet with them first with your spouse, or maybe just yourself, whatever your family dynamic is, and you just have a chat over a cup of coffee, see what they're like. Second interview, bring them into the home. Let them interact with the children. Spend an afternoon with you. See kind of what's going on there. Let your gut instincts really come to the surface. And then here's my big, big point that you really need to follow after that nanny leaves the house. You need to see what your children think of the nanny. If they're old enough to be able to communicate that to you, get their thoughts, get their feedback. Don't discount that, because they have the best cues, those children. They really feel it, and you need to pay attention to what they're saying.
Okay, getting back to films, you mentioned Mrs. Doubtfire. I'm older than you, so I'm still sticking with Mary Poppins. How do you feel about Mary?
Oh, Mary Poppins, that's the quintessential film right there. Mary Poppins really blends together the idea of discipline with play so well. And that's something I really adapted as a nanny. I really wanted to make sure children understood that, and this is a quote from Mary Poppins, that with every task that needs to be done, there is an element of fun. And it really teaches children to be responsible at a young age. And Mary Poppins does a very good job of that. And again, the theme with Mary Poppins, though, is she really came to help the father, to really help the relationship with the father and the children. And I think when you're looking at nanny relationships, there is a big emphasis on making sure that nanny is making a beautiful trifecta in the family, the children, the nanny, and the parents all getting along harmoniously and being a unit that seen together is very strong, compassionate, and secure.
Okay, well, let's look at a little bit of the downside of this, because, again, we've mentioned some movies. There are films out there that don't always put nannies in the best light. And we're also seeing stories in the news which involve nannies coming in between the couple in a relationship. Has that made it more difficult? For instance, in your situation, in being hired, because people are always thinking about some of the negative things that we're hearing in the news about nannies.
Absolutely. I try to push against that stereotype as much as I can. And when you're looking in the media today, you're seeing so much about how these nannies are cheating with the spouses, and you know, how do you trust anyone, and you can't hire an attractive nanny because you can't leave them alone. And I mean, there are so many different factors now that lead to nannies having such a bad reputation. And this might be a little bit too brazen, this might be a little bit too straightforward, but I'm going to say it. how about you just do the right thing? How about you, the nanny, just do the right thing and don't be a home wrecker? And how about you, the family, make sure that you're doing the right thing for your family by making sure that that person coming in is only going to serve in a positive way. So, yes, I mean, right now, I mean, we're looking at the statistics. I mean, 60% of families in America have a nanny. I mean, that's an astounding number. So this is not a trend. This is really something that you're seeing to be a behavior of society now. So people need to start paying attention to what is a very, very important hiring process and a very important piece of the puzzle in a family.
Is there a cause and effect situation? I mean, you've been at this for a while. You're obviously very dedicated to the job. But as I said, there are some negative connotations to what a nanny is. Is it possible that there are some people now getting in the profession with the wrong idea?
I think nannies think sometimes it's easy money. I think that's the biggest negative that I see, that it's just easy money and they're just going to do it until something better comes along or until they get married or, you know, I just don't want to work all that hard, so I'm just going to take care of kids. I mean, I hear people say that and the laughter just falls out of my mouth, because the most honorable job, one of the most honorable jobs you can have, is taking care of another person's most precious possessions, their children. So, yes, that negative connotation that's attached to being a nanny is truthful. I mean, that's coming from a real place, from people's mouths that think that this is what it's like to be a nanny, that it should just be easy. And it's not. You're a role model for these children. You are an extension of the parenting. You are molding these little tiny humans to being everything they've ever dreamed of in their lives. I mean, nannies really need to start looking at really what their role is in that family and how to make the most of it and how to be a positive role model for these children and parents.
What's the general or the average age group for a nanny to be looking after the children? And I'm talking about the age of the child here. And the reason why I ask that question, does it change being a nanny or how you work as a nanny if the child is preschool as opposed to after kindergarten?
Depending on what that family needs, for example, I nannied for children that were an extreme amount of ages. You know, they were newborns to you know, being preteens. So I've seen every facet of it. And when you're caring for a newborn, that's an entirely different dedication that you need versus caring for a child that maybe, like I said, is a pre-teenager and you're taking them back and forth to different activities. So when you're hiring a nanny and you bring them into the house and say, okay, you know, I have this child or I have these children and these are their ages, you're going to want to make sure that their background is specialized in terms of taking care of that child. Are they qualified to take care of a newborn? Newborn needs a lot of specific care versus teenage children. So you're going to, again, go back to that interview process and want to make sure that you are very clear with the nanny about the expectations that you have for them and that their qualifications check out.
We have just about a minute, but I want to mention your book again. Your book is called Nanny and Me. Who did you write the book for specifically?
I wrote it with all of the children that I nannied for in mind. The dedication page is 7 of the children I was with the longest, and I still stay in touch with every single child for which I care today.
Is it more difficult as a nanny to leave a family? And I would assume to a certain degree it's also difficult for the child.
Oh, my goodness. I bawled like a baby. That last nanny baby that I had, I bawled on my way home. And it can be a very, very traumatizing experience for both the nanny and the child, because there is such an attachment, such a bond formed. So just like the transition process of bringing that nanny into the house, you want to make sure if that nanny's leaving for whatever reason it may be, that you concentrate on the child, that remember, it's the child, making sure they're secure and loved and happy and understand it. So you want to make it as seamless as possible.
Excellent. Again, the book is called Nanny and Me. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is windycitynanny.com. Are you still working as a nanny?
I am not. I am retired, but I still love to stay in touch with all the kiddos. And a great part of having this book is that I get to do lots of school visits and signings, and I still get to stay very much connected.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Florence, for being on the program with us. Pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. Thanks so much.
Florence Ann Romano, the Windy City Nanny and author of Nanny and Me. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0337, and you'll find the links to Florence's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
17-year-old Jason Hayes was arrested in a Philadelphia suburb in January when he arrived for a scheduled appointment with a robbery victim from the night before. According to police, Hayes had attempted to shake down a woman in her home, but was still dissatisfied with the money she had on hand. Fearful, she agreed to bring more the next day if they met at a local shopping mall, and he agreed. He also promised to wear the same clothes so that she would recognize him. She, of course, called the police. He is now behind bars. Now why? Oh, why would you as a robber agree to meet with your victim at an appointed location for a second time, presumably for a second shakedown? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0337. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0337. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.